Vamos a dar inicio a esta última sesión que me parece muy importante para América Latina y a nombre de Sencida doy las gracias por esta invitación y estos temas sin duda de gran avance y como herramienta de prevención nos servirán mucho para escuchar los últimos avances de la circuncisión de los microbicidas para la prevención del VIH. Y dejo la palabra al doctor Kevin para continuar la mesa.
Colleagues, friends, good afternoon and welcome to the late breakers of Track C. My congratulations to all the speakers and their colleagues for getting these important abstracts accepted. Without further ado, let's go to the first presentation. The protective effect of male circumcision is sustained for at least 42 months. Results from the Kisumu, Kenya trial presented by Dr. Bob Bailey and colleagues. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you, Kevin. So I first want to thank the organizers for inviting us to give this presentation, also to all my collaborators, just a few of whom are shown on this slide, and of course the many young men who've participated in our studies over the last 6.5 years. In the interest of time, I'm going to read my presentation. And one of the main concerns that's been expressed about the evidence for male circumcision, its protective effect against HIV acquisition, has been that all three trials of circumcision were stopped before planned completion. And the studies extended only 18 to 24 months. Skeptics have said that the protective effect of circumcision will likely be eroded after periods of longer than 24 months. So here we report extended follow-up from our cohort in Kisumu out to 42 months or 3 years. So we've previously reported findings from the first 24 months of the trial in Kisumu. We reported a 53% protective effect of circumcision in intent to treat analysis and a 59% protective effect of circumcision in a modified intent to treat analysis. On December 12, 2006, the Data Safety Monitoring Board, upon review of these results, advised NIH and ourselves to unblind the study. So in December 2006, we began offering circumcision to controls. We had already circumcised a proportion of men who had completed their 24 months of participation in the trial, and in March 2006, we reconsented those men who were still remaining in the study. And we will continue follow-up on them until September 2009. So the purpose of this presentation is to report first the slight modifications to our previous findings based on further laboratory analyses, and second, to report results from continued follow-up of circumcised and uncircumcised men up to 42 months post-randomization. Initially, 2,784 men ages 18 to 24 years were randomized to circumcision or delayed circumcision. With all the participants, we performed HIV testing, behavioral counseling, we administered a behavioral questionnaire, conducted clinical exam, and collected urine and blood for STI testing. We did this at baseline and every 6 months thereafter, and participants also underwent HIV testing and received behavioral counseling at 1 and 3 months, and thus any man who was circumcised was asked to return to the clinic at 3, 8, and 30 days post-circumcision in order to check the wound and to counsel them about wound care and abstinence from sex. Originally, we reported that at unblinding of the trial in an intent to treat analysis, there were 22 HIV seroconversions in the circumcision group and 47 in the controls. This resulted in a risk ratio of 0.47, or a 53% protective effect of circumcision against HIV acquisition. These are the results that are most often reported for our study. However, we also reported a modified intent to treat analysis in which we excluded 4 seroconverters whom we found to be HIV positive at baseline. This analysis, which is most comparable to the results reported from Rakai and Orange Farm, and undoubtedly reflect a more accurate estimate, resulted in a relative risk of 0.41 or a 59% protective effect. So subsequent to our publication of results in The Lancet, we've sent samples to Tom Quinn's lab at NIAID for sensitive PCR, and I want to thank Oliver Leidendecker for assistance with analyzing those samples. These further analyses result in some slight changes to our original findings. Two men in the circumcision group previously considered positive at baseline turned out to be negative. One participant in the circumcision group considered as a seroconverter at 3 months turned out to be positive at baseline. And one participant in the control group previously considered a 12-month seroconverter turns out to have been negative throughout follow-up. So these results, or these modifications, result in a revised modified intent to treat analysis that finds 18 seroconversions over the 24 months of follow-up in the circumcision group and 45 seroconversions in the control group, a relative risk of 0.40, or a 60% protective effect of circumcision. So the updated HIV testing results in these small changes to our original estimates. So now turning to our extended follow-up, of the original 2,784 men randomized at the beginning of the trial, 1,739 were eligible for extended follow-up. Of these, 89% consented, approximately equal numbers in the two groups, and 1,491, or 97%, of these now remain on study. So we looked to see if there were differences between the men in the control group who chose to become circumcised and those who chose to remain uncircumcised. We found there to be no differences at baseline, and this also means that there are no differences at baseline between those controls who became circumcised and those men who were originally randomized to the circumcision group. So here is shown a Kaplan-Meier plot of an intent-to-treat analysis of data extending to 42 months, or 3.5 years of follow-up. The analysis is based on 24 seroconversions in the circumcision group, representing a cumulative seroincidence of 2.6% compared to 65 seroconversions in the uncircumcised group, representing a cumulative seroincidence of 7.4%. The relative risk of circumcision is 0.36, or a protective effect of circumcision against HIV acquisition over the 3.5 years of follow-up of 64%. When we do an as-treated analysis, the result's the same with only slightly wider confidence intervals. It's worth noting that we had some concern when reporting our original trial results that there were almost an equal number of seroconversions during the interval between 18 and 24 months, 8 seroconversions in the circumcision group and 10 in the control group. This suggested that the protective effect of circumcision may be declining. These new results, however, dispel those concerns. We did additional analyses. This Kaplan-Meier plot shows HIV seroincidence in men circumcised within 2 weeks of randomization compared to participants in the control group using their follow-up experience up to the time that they were circumcised. In other words, these uncircumcised men are censored when they become circumcised. So this is purely experience of circumcision versus no circumcision. The cumulative HIV seroincidence in the circumcised men over the 42 months of follow-up is 2.7% versus 8% in those who remain uncircumcised. The relative risk of HIV infection for circumcised men is essentially the same as in the previous analysis. In this case, it's 0.35, or a 65% protective effect of circumcision against HIV acquisition. These analyses result in an average annual seroincidence of 0.77 infections per 100 person years in the circumcised men and 2.37 infections per 100 person years in the uncircumcised men. Again, this is a relative risk of 0.35, and the difference is highly significant. So there are limitations to our study. There are changes to the two groups because of crossovers from control to circumcision. So men in the control group who've opted for circumcision may be different from the controls who've remained uncircumcised. Although we've looked at that, and excuse me, and We've looked at this and found no significant differences in demographic or risk profiles between the two groups. Extended follow-up beyond 24 months is available on a smaller sample than the original 2,784 participants. And as yet, few person years of exposure have accrued among those in the delayed circumcision group. We intend to continue following up these men until September 2009, so we'll have more data on experiences of both circumcised and uncircumcised men. So the conclusions to be garnered from these results are that further laboratory testing of specimens from the original trial result in only small changes to our original findings, and the 60% protective effect of circumcision against HIV acquisition that we found in sexually active men in Kisumu, Kenya, over the first 24 months of study, we now find to be sustained and possibly strengthened to approximately 65% over 3.5 years of follow-up. So these results further support the addition of male circumcision to our existing limited armamentarium of HIV prevention interventions, and to provide safe, voluntary, free medical male circumcision services in appropriate regions as rapidly as possible. Thank you.
Bob, can I suggest perhaps that we do both presentations on male circumcision and take questions afterwards?
Yes. Thank you very much, Bob. That's a very important study. So now, Dr. Diftalyart will present the effect of male circumcision on human papillomavirus, Neisseria gonorrhea, and Trichomonas vaginalis infections in men, results from a randomized controlled trial. And this work was done in South Africa. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you to the organizers for giving me this opportunity to speak. The title of my story this afternoon is male circumcisions and the effect on HPV, gonorrhea, and TV infections in young men. So the background is, what do we know about male circumcision in men? We know that male circumcision reduces the HIV infection in men, and we've got 3 randomized controlled trials to show that. We know that male circumcision reduces HSV2 infection from 2 randomized controlled trials, and we know that male circumcision reduces genital ulcer disease in men from 2 randomized controlled trials. We also have observational data that tell us that urinary tract infection in babies are reduced, and that there's a reduction of syphilis, chancroid, and HPV infection, as well as invasive penile cancer, which is probably due to the effect of HPV. There is, however, conflicting results about non-ulcerative STIs, for instance, gonorrhea, chlamydia, and TV. For women, there's conflicting results about male-to-female transmission of HIV, but at least we think that on a population level, women will have an indirect benefit in the fact that there will be less infected men around. We know that male circumcision reduces TV from 1 randomized controlled trial. We know that male circumcision reduces genital ulcer disease in women from 1 randomized controlled trial. And we know that male circumcision reduces the risk of cervical cancer in female partners of circumcised men, also probably due to the link with TV, HPV. So the objective of this study was to assess the effect of male circumcision on high-risk HPV, gonorrhea, and TV infections in young men, using the data from the Orange Farm male circumcision randomized control trial, the NRS1265. The methods for this trial included a screening process. All men had to be between the ages of 18 to 24, uncircumcised at the start of at inclusion. We then saw them at inclusion after 3 months, 12 months, and 21 months visits. At each visit, we took a blood sample. We did a clinical examination. We also did a behavioral questionnaire and offered VCT. Shortly, a few days after screening, participants were randomized into 2 groups, into an intervention group where they were circumcised straight away. And then we followed both groups after 3 months, 12 months, and 21 months. Those of the control group after the 21 months were offered circumcision, and most of them took it up. We collected additional samples at the 21-month visit. We collected 318 days worth of urine samples, and then we collected urethral swabs for 262 days. The laboratory methods we employed, we tested the urine samples with PCR for gonorrhea and for TV, and we used the PCR-based method from Roche for the urethral swabs that identified 13 high-risk genotypes of HPV. The most important of these is type 16 and 18 due to their link with cervical cancer in women. The statistical methods used, we did a prevalence study on circumcised versus uncircumcised and an intention to treat analysis. And we did an analysis of intervention versus control in an as-treated analysis. We calculated odds ratios and adjusted odds ratios using logistical regression and control for covariates of ethnic group, education, age, number of lifetime partners, marital status, condom use, and we used an HIV status propensity score. So the results. In gonorrhea, we see the intervention and control groups. You can see the difference between the intervention and control is 10% versus 10.3, and in uncircumcised and uncircumcised, 10.4 versus 10, with odds ratios very close to 1, and these were not significant. This led us to believe that male circumcision had no effect on gonorrhea. Then for TV, you can see in the intervention group, we had 1.7% prevalence, and in the control, 3.1%. And in the circumcised and uncircumcised, we had 1.6% versus 3.2% prevalence. This gave us odds ratios of 0.49, and you can see borderline significance. So we concluded that male circumcision has a borderline protective effect on TV. And then for high-risk HPV, you can see again the difference between the intervention and control. In the intervention, we had 15.8% prevalence, and the control, 24.8%, and this was significant. And then in the circumcision, in the circumcision status, we had 15.2% for the circumcised and 25.5% for the uncircumcised, giving us an odds ratio of 0.52 and 0.44, respectively, for unadjusted and unadjusted. And you can see that in both instances, this was significant. This led to the conclusion that male circumcision has a protective effect against high-risk HPV with a prevalence rate ratio of 0.64 and a protective effect of about 36%. Do male circumcision have a different effect on different HPV genotypes? You can see in the graph that there's quite a lot of variance between the different genotypes. We're not sure whether the effect, whether male circumcision actually affects these genotypes differently, or whether this could be a random effect due to the sample size, which at this level of analysis was quite small. And then there are some discussion and some opinions that lower detection in circumcised men is because of the sample taking. To test this, we took 371 men from the control group who were circumcised, and we compared the urethral swabs taken before and after circumcision. So before they were circumcised, we took a urethral swab, and then with a mean of 59 days and a median of 43 days after their circumcision, we took a urethral swab again. We analyzed these swabs and for high-risk HPV prevalence, and in the first instance, the prevalence was 26.4%, and in the second instance, 26.1%. So you can see it was very consistent over this short space of time, which led us to believe that the effect on HPV cannot be due to the differential sensitivity of HPV detection between circumcised and uncircumcised men. Could the effect be due to the effect of male circumcision on HIV? We excluded those who seroconverted for HIV during the follow-up with the same result for HPV and for TV. So, in other words, the effect that male circumcision has on HIV did not influence the effect that male circumcision had on HPV and TV. There are some limitations to the study. We have no biological status of the partners, and in fact, a lot of these young men did not have permanent partners. The status at inclusion was not available, and the effect we are looking at is the effect on prevalence and not on incidence. However, we are confident about the findings because of the following factors. The group was randomized in the beginning, which would mean that there's no reason to believe that the HPV status at randomization between the two groups would be different. We've analyzed the effect with and without adjustment. We analyzed the effect in an intention to treat and an as-treated analysis. And we also have to remember that this study was done in young men and prevalence should rise. In fact, the fact that the prevalence was higher in the control group than in the intervention group at the end of study means that there was some incidence. We concluded that lower high-risk HPV and TV prevalence among circumcised men is likely due to a lower incidence, which could lead to a lower female-to-male transmission. These results may explain why several studies, including one RCT, have shown that women with circumcised partners are at lower risk of TV infection. In fact, the study suggests that it is the result of lower risk of TV infection in circumcised men as compared to uncircumcised men that could be responsible for this. These results may also explain why several observational studies have shown that women with circumcised partners are at lower risk of cervical cancer, most of them due to high-risk HPV. Indeed, the study suggests that this is the result of lower risk of HPV infection amongst circumcised men compared to uncircumcised men. This paper has been accepted by the Journal of Infectious Diseases and is currently in press and should appear shortly. I'd like to thank our sponsors, the NRS and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who funded the additional testing, and then all our colleagues of INSERM, the National Institute for Communicable Diseases, University of Versailles. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dirk. I suggest then that both these papers be open for questions. Could you please identify who you are and please keep your questions as succinct as possible?
Okay. My name is Bruno Hearn. I'm from France. My question is to Dr. Bailey. I'd like to understand why so many uncircumcised men remained so while they were offered to be circumcised and were aware of the protective effect of circumcision from the results of the trial they were enrolled in.
Hello? It's a good question. About 42% of the controls have now been circumcised, and one of the reasons that there hasn't been larger uptake is that many of these men have moved away from Kisumu and live in Mombasa, Nairobi, and other cities. So, we have been required by the IRBs and by NIH to continue that follow-up of ensuring that we see them at 3, 8, and 30 days post-circumcision. We think that that's a very large deterrent. A lot of them have come to us or called us, say they want circumcision, but when we say you're required to stay for a longer period of time, then they don't come.
Microphone 3. Yes.
Kelly Curran from Japago. Just a quick question for Bob Bailey. I was really curious to see the number of men who were initially classified as HIV positive who were then reclassified following the more sensitive testing in Tom Quinn's lab or vice versa. Could you comment on that a little bit and for the implications of those of us that work in HIV counseling and testing?
Yeah, one thing I've learned during this trial is that the science of determination of HIV is far from a science, actually. And we've had a lot of difficulties, and I know other groups have as well, in actually coming to determinations about definite seroconverters versus borderline or indeterminates. And we used rapid tests and ELISAs, double ELISAs, to determine seroconversion. And then we did LIAs in Canada. But we found still there to be conflicting results. So we believe that Tom Quinn's lab is probably one of the best, if not the best. And so using more sensitive techniques, these are the results that we've considered to be determinant. But it's never easy, and I think people should be skeptical sometimes about determination of seroconversions.
Microphone 2.
George Rutherford from the United States for Professor Bailey. I think I may have missed it, but was there a relatively parallel incidence between the circumcised and uncircumcised groups after about 2.5 years of follow-up? That is, are you starting to see, and so the speculation would be that if the incidence rates remained relatively the same in those later years, that you might be seeing a community-level preventive benefit of circumcision?
Yeah, I mean, there hasn't been so much uptake in the community of circumcision that I think you're going to see a drop in incidence due to circumcision in the community. But the rates are quite consistent across all 5 years of our study. And the relative risk is increasing slightly, but it's really, you know, within confidence limits, so we can't really say that the relative risk is changing.
Thank you.
Could I ask if there's any some questions for Derek's study? Yes, could you come to the microphone, please?
Actually, mine is partly Kevin.
Could you? It's Daniel Halpern. Good Lord.
Yes, it is. We're old friends, aren't we, Kevin? I still remember the days when we weren't allowed to talk about this subject. Actually, can I ask you a question, Kevin?
No, stick to the speakers. Stick to the speakers. We'll see if there's any time left.
Okay, then I'll wait, because it's a question for WHO.
They're invisible at this conference.
Yeah, hello, my name is Georgia N. Chapin. I wonder what kind of consideration has been given to the effect of the intervention itself, the fact that the men who were circumcised were given more attention and more follow-up, and whether that was considered particularly in the HPV, differential in HPV, were they more likely to use condoms with their partners? I know that according to your studies, you encouraged men to use condoms, and one would assume that the people in the experimental group would have had a higher degree of education in condom use. Was that considered at all in the differential incidence after the study period?
I think that the condom use was quite consistent between the two, between the control and the intervention groups. And
can you speak into the microphone?
Okay. I think that the condom use was quite consistent between the control and intervention groups, and we don't think that this played a role.
Could I ask you a question, Dirk? Does that answer your question? Was there another question for Dirk? Or,
yes, please.
Yep, okay.
Hi, I'm Nicola Lowe from the University of Bern in Switzerland. A question about the STI data. Can I ask you very briefly why you didn't test for chlamydia? And secondly, what you speculate as being the reason for the lack of effect on gonorrhea but effect on trichomonas?
The short answer is funding and for not testing for chlamydia. And then for gonorrhea, no, I really don't have an explanation.
Microphone 3.
Kubota from the United States. The HPV data, could it be a matter of persistence as opposed to acquisition? You only tested at one point in time?
Yes, we only tested it at one visit, yes. So I think it's possible. But for some of the control, we did test after 21 months and again after 6 weeks. And in that testing, it was quite consistent.
Daniel?
Thanks, Kevin. If you can't answer it, Dirk can partially answer. The two questions I would have mainly for WHO. One, in the kind of more sophisticated reanalysis that Bob Bailey's talked about, where you're looking both at the biology of seroconversions and longer follow-up, as we start to get this from the other trials, the effect size may potentially grow. It looks like they've gone from roughly 55% from the published article to now 65%. If we see a similar trend in the other trials, is there any possibility that WHO may up its 60% estimate? That's the one question. Estimate for the HIV protective effect may end up being somewhat higher, up in the 65% or 70% range. Second question, maybe more importantly, is given the strength of the evidence on cervical cancer in particular, or predictors for cervical cancer, and maybe we'll end up getting data on cervical cancer and on TV, is there any possibility that WHO may endorse male circumcision as a holistic reproductive health measure for both men and women and not only as a strictly HIV prevention modality?
I've got WHO colleagues sitting there itching to comment. Kim, why don't you come to the microphone? Let me answer it perhaps at the I just want to ask another question, then I'll comment on what Daniel's just asked. Can I ask, Dirk, what do you think is the biological mechanism of protection against HPV? And, you know, can you see us getting into a debate internationally about whether it's more important to circumcise men or give HPV vaccine to women?
I think, as with HIV, the biological mechanism is not yet determined, and it's very difficult in this case to say why, because you have to keep in mind that these were urethral swabs, not swabs taken on the outside or on the inside of the foreskin. So we've speculated a lot about the biological mechanism, but it's not clear, and I really don't know.
Let's close this down. Let me just quickly comment on Daniel's question. I mean, I think, Daniel, to try and get a point estimate of efficacy, I think, is somewhat artificial. And I think that the qualitative description that is out there from WHO and UNAIDS is adequate for the public health message to get across. As far as your second point is concerned, I mean, I do certainly see, and you know how global norms and standards gets made. I do see that there will be future discussions and consultations and so on about the broader aspects of male circumcision, especially as more data of this kind of nature become available. So let me thank both of you, for being so collaborative also in answering questions together. Let's move on. We're a little bit behind time. I'll introduce the next speaker, and then I'm going to hand the chair over to my colleague, Dr. Cabral. So the third presentation, which is being presented by my friend and colleague from CDC, Dr. Walid Henaina, is entitled Complete Protection Against Repeated Vaginal Shiv Exposures in Macaques by a Combination Emtricitabine and Tenofovir Topical Gel.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure to be here to present this data on behalf of our group in the lab branch at CDC. So we'll move to the cousin species of ours, the pigtail macaques here, to evaluate this particular strategy of microbicides. As you have all heard in this meeting, HIV continues to spread globally, mainly through heterosexual sex, and in many parts of the world, women are disproportionately affected by HIV. And obviously, in the absence of HIV vaccine, alternative biomedical interventions are critically needed. Vaginal microbicide gels can provide a female control prevention strategy. However, the microbicide gels tested thus far that contain the first-generation products like surfactants and polyanions have been ineffective. However, antiretroviral drug-based gels, as you probably have heard in this meeting, may be more promising and can deliver potent drugs at the virus point of entry. So the question with these gels is what modality is productive? Is it gels containing single or combination antiretroviral drugs will likely be more effective? We have ongoing trials now with 1% tenofovir, which is a nucleotide RT inhibitor. Data reported actually this week by Krenich et al. In PLOS Medicine show that this gel is protective against rectal transmission in a macaque model. However, combination NRTI gels may be more protective than gels with single NRTIs because of the higher antiviral potency. They can also be more effective against circulating drug-resistant viruses. And we already know from monkey work done in our lab and others that in oral pre-exposure prophylaxis, combination NRTIs such as Truvada was more protective than single drugs alone. So our study goals were threefold. First, can a tenofovir and an FTC be co-formulated into a topical gel? And can this drug combination protect female pigtail macaques from vaginal SHIV infection? And which modality is protective? Single application before virus exposure or daily application? First, regarding co-formulation, we were able to successfully formulate 1% tenofovir plus 5% FTC, and the higher dose of FTC was possible because of the high water solubility of this drug. These were formulated in what's known as universal placebo, hydroxyethyl cellulose, or HEC, 2%, and to provide a clear, odorless, and viscous gel. We've tested stability over time at different temperatures, including 37 degrees, and this gel was stable for up to 6 months. So regarding evaluating the efficacy of gel in a monkey model, we devised a study with three arms. First one containing no gel, arm with two animals, placebo gel that has no drugs with six animals, and the gel with the combination drugs, again with six animals. What kind of macaque model we've used for our study? We've used the repeated low-dose vaginal model, originally developed by Ron Otten and Tom Folks in our lab. And this model closely resembles human transmission in many ways. First, the virus challenge contains, which is SHIV-162P3 strain, contains an R5 tropic HIV-1 envelope, similar to most transmitted viruses. The inoculum is more physiologic. It's lower dose than the classical single high-dose challenge models. And more importantly, virus inoculations are repeated in the animals. In this study, it was twice weekly so that we can assess protection over several exposure and repeated exposure. Protection was measured by the degree infection is prevented or delayed relative to controls. So this is the detail of the applications of gels and challenge. So we, twice weekly each time, we apply 3 milliliters of the gel, followed 30 minutes later by a blood collection, and then immediately a challenge with the virus. And as I said, this was done twice weekly for up to 10 weeks. Animals that did not show any sign of infection were followed for an additional 10 weeks by diagnostic testing for evidence of infection. Monitoring of infection was done in real time twice weekly on each of the blood sample that was collected. And samples were tested for RNA-PCR, followed by proviral DNA-PCR and antibody testing. So an animal is considered positive if they show these signs of these diagnostic markers. Animals are considered negative if all these three tests were consistently negative in real time and after 10 weeks of follow-up. So here's the results of the study. First, in white, you see the two controls that received no gel. Both of them got infected early on. And then in blue, you see the six animals that received the placebo gel, again getting infected around the same time. We have one late infection here, but one of the six animals remained resistant after 20 challenges. The median to infection in this group is about 3.5 challenges. In contrast, all animals that received the tenofovir FTC gel remained uninfected after 20 challenges. Of note here, since the median to infection is 3.5 in the controls, so an animal that was remained protected after 20 challenges would have been protected against a median of around 6 transmission events. This is the acute viremia in the controls that are typical with this virus in this model that show, similar to what you see in humans, a peak of 6 to 7 logs of RNA that goes down over time. All the placebo and the control gels showed virus RNA followed by seroconversion and proviral DNA detection in the peripheral blood lymphocytes. In contrast, all the protected animals had negative results in these tests. We also, from that sample collected 30 minutes after a gel application, we measured the plasma levels of FTC, tenofovir, to get an idea about the systemic drug exposures in these animals. And consistent with what you see in human studies, we see with both drugs were detectable, and with the majority were at low levels, including a median of 67 nanograms for FTC and a median of 23 nanograms per ml for tenofovir. So in conclusions, an FTC tenofovir combination gel conferred complete protection against repeated vaginal exposures in pigtail macaques. The low levels of both FTC and tenofovir in plasma 30 minutes after application suggest rapid drug absorption with relatively higher levels of drug remaining in vaginal tissue. The single gel application before virus exposure in this model is sufficient for high protection. Daily gel application is therefore not needed. This model identified a highly effective strategy and thus supports further evaluation of FTC tenofovir gel in human clinical trials. I'd like to finish by acknowledging the tremendous amount of work done by our group, in particular Irvi Parekh, who was a postdoc that led this work and got a lot of help from Sunita and Mir and Charles, who were helping with this real-time diagnostic testing and all the logistics. Obviously, a lot of help from gel formulation of Hongwei, the protocols, drug levels as well, and the statistics. And Yerkes investigators, Frank November's group, for their help in the animal testing. And would like to also thank Jim Rooney and colleagues from Gilead who provided the drugs with part of a material transfer agreement with the CDC. Thank you.
Thank you, Walid. This paper is open for questions. Microphone 4.
A couple of questions.
Could you say who you are?
Gus Cairns, UK. Firstly, how does the systemic levels of FTC and tenofovir compare with what you'd see after an oral dose?
Well, we measured the 30 minutes, obviously, here only. But from additional data we have, we're looking over a 24 period of time, those levels are substantially lower than what you see in oral TDF treatment, at least tenfold or more lower. So the systemic drug exposure from these topical applications would, in fact, lead to very low systemic exposure, which argues probably for less drug toxicity.
Isn't that therefore, if it's only tenfold lower, wouldn't that be possibly cause resistance if somebody was seroconverting if they had that kind of level in their blood?
In fact, the low systemic drug exposure would not promote a drug selection. In fact, from all the data we have from treatment, you need higher drug levels to sustain drug selection and of resistant viruses. So this would argue actually the opposite way.
Okay, I've got one more. Nobody else.
I think could we ask? There is actually at the back. Oh, microphone one.
Oh, hi, my name is Juan Valdez, and we're here. I just have a quick question. What do you think caused that one monkey to be resistant to 20 challenges?
We have these outliers from even with our rectal model. Usually they're at a frequency of 1 in 30 animals or so. This happened to be in the first eight we've tested. We have now additional controls that they're all getting infected again within the median. No clue. We're looking at some resistance factors and innate factors, but it's a very interesting. This would be actually some material to look at natural resistance to infection.
Thanks.
Dr. Cairns.
Thanks for the doctor. I'm a mister. The other question was, exactly how do you do the inoculation with the SHIV, and have you considered developing models which mimic sexual trauma and or STI infection?
The virus is titrated and is put in buffer and is applied in the vaginal cavity with no trauma. So obviously there is the other issues of whether you can do those efficacy studies in the background of STIs. But at this point, this is the first set of studies where we want to do it in a very clean manner to get a sense of the efficacy of these drugs and these gels.
Khalid, can I ask you, how do you decide how many monkeys to use? And I think these are extremely impressive data, and I think actually your group needs a lot of congratulations for giving such biological plausibility in your various work to the human trials that are going on. But how do you, if we said, well, we protected 6 humans, you know, everybody would say, well, go home. How do you decide how many monkeys to use, and how do you, what kind of, do you apply any statistical analyses to any of these observations? Or?
Yeah, you're obviously with monkeys, because of cost and logistics, you're always going to be limited with the numbers. So you develop the model that simulates as close as possible the human transmission or main conditions of human transmission. However, we've tried to work around that in this model by doing repeated exposure. So each animal, the end statistics you will get will be a very strong measure of efficacy of your product, because the protected animals in this case would at least be, would avert 6 transmission events. So yes, it is 6, but it is in fact a large number of transmissions that you have averted with your product if you see protection. The small numbers is an inherent limitation of monkey models. Unfortunately, we can't do 20 and 20 because of cost effectiveness. But these are proof of principle experiments that come very close to measure, to address specific questions about potency of the product, role of 2 drugs versus 1 drug under identical conditions. So you can get useful information that help.
And how would you, if somebody said to you, well, what's the difference between using a product rectally or orally when it's the same compound, the same drug, what would you say that biological differences?
There is big differences in the dosage, which was the first question. And TGF, the oral formulation, is very different than the tenofovir that is formulated in the gel. So the PK studies that now have been done in humans, as well as we're doing them in the monkeys, would shed light on the differences between oral versus topical with 2 versions of the same drug, and what are the intracellular actually concentrations of these drugs from oral versus topical application. But there are distinct differences.
I'm sorry, I took up time. Could you say a very quick final question?
Sure. Emily Bass from AVAC, the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition. So the ARV-based prophylaxis field has already once reacted to data from an animal study showing more efficacy with a combination drug and has switched the drug in human trials. Based on this trial, what's your feeling, given that there's a single drug topical gel going into efficacy studies, what's your feeling about how to proceed?
Yes, this is the first study in the series of investigation we'll be doing. Right now we have started a similar study with tenofovir, 1% tenofovir only, to address the question that you've raised. Do we really need, if we are delivering a lot of drug topically, do we really need 2, or 1 is enough? So we hope the second study will address this question.
Okay, thank you very much, Walid. And I'd like to give the chair to Jose. Thank you.
Gracias. Doctora Atia, adelante, por favor. La siguiente.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Buenas tardes, señoras y señores. It is a pleasure to speak here at my first International AIDS Conference. So, can unsafe sex be safe? Today we will discuss current evidence on HIV-1 transmission rates according to viral load and under the influence of highly active antiretroviral treatment and sexually transmitted infections. To give you some context, our research is in response to a statement published in January of this year by the Swiss National AIDS Commission. This statement declared that the risk for an HIV-positive person to transmit HIV through unprotected sex is less than 1 in 100,000 if that individual has a blood viral load less than 40 copies per milliliter for at least 6 months, is fully adherent to antiretroviral therapy with regular follow-up by a physician and does not have any other sexually transmitted infections. As you may know, the statement created a large amount of controversy nationally and internationally among physicians and community alike. If you are interested, the transcript and video of a satellite session on this statement at this year's conference are available. Our objectives. We at the Institute of Social and Preventive Medicine of the University of Bern believe that such a statement, indeed any public health statement, with such far-reaching consequences, demands a thorough and statistically based evaluation of current literature. Therefore, our objectives were to conduct a systematic review of longitudinal studies on HIV transmission in serodiscordant couples and, where possible, to perform a meta-analysis of HIV transmission rates in those with undetectable viral load without sexually transmitted infections and with and without HART. Our systematic review began with a search of literature from 1996, when viral load testing became widely available. We included full-length articles, citations from those articles, and abstracts of HIV-discordant couples which documented HIV transmissions and viral loads in the HIV-positive partner. We conducted the review according to recommended standards, with two reviewers assessing eligibility and extracting data independently. We are currently collecting additional data from authors. For studies awaiting follow-up times, we have estimated the follow-up time from the published mean or median follow-up time. Where data were available, we used a random effects model to combine results and estimate the HIV transmission rate. This method takes into account statistical heterogeneity in results from different studies and study populations. In the absence of HIV transmissions, we obtained an estimate of the upper 95% confidence interval using an approximate method. We defined STIs as syphilis, chlamydia, gonorrhea, or genital herpes, and classified studies as STI status unclear if study authors either did not stratify their data according to the presence or absence of STIs or did not perform diagnostic tests for these infections. Our transmission rates are measured in rate per 100 person years and not per coital act, as that assessment was not extractable. In addition, we used a limit of detection of 400, not 40, copies per milliliter of blood viral load, as this was the limit reported in most studies. Our systematic literature search yielded 252 publications, of which 241 studies were excluded due to duplication, irrelevant topic or study design, or refusal of additional data from study authors. We were left with 14 potential cohorts comprised of 7 published or in-press papers, and 7 studies published as abstracts. We are still awaiting some study information and may be forced to exclude additional cohorts in our final analysis due to incomplete information. This slide summarizes studies which we have included so far. By region, the greatest number of discordant couples and transmissions came from Africa, with only 424 from Europe. Only one study noted the inclusion of men having sex with men. All other studies reported heterosexual relationships without conclusive information about the types of sexual acts. Most importantly, 9 cohorts reported use of HART in the HIV-positive partner in 428 couples. In addition, 8 cohorts reported some information on sexually transmitted infections among a total of 1,056 couples. We are currently awaiting clarification on those numbers. We were able to conduct a meta-analysis to combine available data in the groups that are presented on this slide. Our systematic review did not identify any studies which fulfilled the Swiss statement criteria, that is, having individuals on HART with an undetectable viral load and no other sexually transmitted infections. In this group, we did not include one study of 22 couples because the HIV-negative partners received pre-exposure prophylaxis. Only one other study contained HIV-positive individuals on HART with undetectable viral load. However, the STI status of these individuals remains unclear. The transmission rate in this study was 0 per 100 person years from 283.2 person years of follow-up. This gives an upper confidence interval of 1.06 transmissions per 100 person year. All other studies were in HART-naive individuals. Only one transmission occurred within these groups at a level of 362 copies per milliliter of blood viral load. Can unsafe sex be safe? In summary, we have not yet identified any studies which directly quantify the transmission risk of HIV-positive individuals on HART with consistently undetectable viral load and no other STIs. However, a body of indirect evidence suggests that transmission of HIV infection at low viral load levels is very rare. We did not identify any studies or case reports in which HIV transmission occurred at a viral load below 40 copies per milliliter. Some limitations of our study include a lack of data on types of sexual acts. And as a comment on this, a recent modeling study from Australia, available in Lancet July 26 to August 1 edition of this year, suggests that the Swiss statement may not be generalizable to men having sex with men engaging in unprotected anal sex. In addition, we have a lack of complete data in our studies on protected and unprotected sex within our couples. Other limitations include a minimal detection of viral load assays as 400 copies per milliliter, as I said before, and an inability to determine the duration of viral suppression. It is also difficult to know about the importance of STIs to HIV transmission risk in individuals on HART because of a lack of consistent measurement of STIs significant to HIV transmission, especially genital herpes, and a lack of numbers on those with STI diagnosis. It is important to note that this review is ongoing. We hope that incoming data will allow us to increase the precision of our estimates. So is it possible for an empirical study to estimate a transmission risk of less than 1 in 100,000? In a very simplistic calculation, if we assume a coital frequency of 8 per month, it turns out that in order to achieve an upper 95% confidence interval of 1 in 100,000, only one transmission can occur in 550,000 coital acts. Amassing this number of coital acts with a frequency of 8 coital acts per month would require 1,145 couples followed for 5 years. We are aware of at least one study of heterosexual HIV transmission in serodiscordant couples with HART use in the HIV-positive partner. This study approaches the levels of couples and follow-up time estimated by the calculations I just mentioned and has an expected finish time of 20,016. We hope that it will therefore more precisely establish transmission risk per coital act for the growing number of couples reaching undetectable viral loads under HART. It is now the accepted standard of practice to perform systematic reviews and meta-analyses in the development of statements which are intended to guide clinical decisions or public health recommendations. In addition, authors of such statements must always clarify the source, the quality, and the direct applicability of supporting evidence to the study topic. We recommend an increase in research on HIV transmission in serodiscordant couples with the HIV-positive partner on HART, and a specific investigation of the effects of different types of sexual acts, symptomatic as well as asymptomatic and intermittent sexually transmitted infections as well as reproductive infections, and the influence of viral load dynamics in blood and genital secretions. We're very grateful to the study authors who actually were able to give us additional data and to those who hopefully will provide us some after their publications are done. And I would personally like to thank my co-authors, Matthias Egger, and especially Nicola Lowe, who is also here in the audience. Thank you for your attention. Nicola and I will be more than happy to take your questions.
Muchas gracias, doctora. Si quieren, podemos pasar a las preguntas.
Oh, hello. Edwin Bernard from the UK, reporting for AIDSMAP. Hi, I was at the Sunday Satellite, and I remember you actually stood up and talked about how you'd identified the threshold of transmission at being 362 copies per mil. Can you tell me where that study was from and what was the next level after 362?
Sure. So the lowest detectable load transmission was in 362 copies per milliliter, as you said. This was in a study performed by Jesus Castilla in 2005, and he did this study in Spain. And I believe the next, I don't want to give you the wrong number, but I believe the next viral load was around 1,479, but I would like to just check my data and give you an accurate number.
Kubota from the United States. What do you think the implications of these this study is for seroconcordant couples who are persistently, perhaps on treatment, persistently with negative viral loads, and potentially even with same resistance backgrounds.
Could you please speak louder? I actually didn't hear your question.
What are the implications for serial concordant couples with persistently undetectable viral loads on treatment with, say, for instance, the same resistance background with their viruses? Serial concordant couples.
So your question is, what is the implications for serial concordant couples? Well, right now, I mean, our study is focusing only on serodiscordant couples, and I actually can't tell you the implications for seroconcordant. I don't know if Nicola has anything to add to that. No, not really. Yeah, sorry. It's an excellent question, one that should be addressed by our scientific community.
Tim Farley from WHO. I much enjoyed your analysis. And I agree the Swiss National AIDS Commission was probably a bit naughty in not doing the meta-analysis before making their recommendations. And you've shown us the sort of data that would need to be there for them to make an evidence-based recommendation. However, the recommendation is out there now, and I'd just like you to speculate, well, what information would you have to say that the recommendation is wrong?
Okay, so the question is, what information do we have to say that the Swiss statement is wrong?
No, I mean, you don't have any information to say the Swiss statement is wrong at the moment, but what sort of information would you need to say that the Swiss information is wrong, and are we ever going to get that?
So, to make matters simple, we would need to see transmissions under 40 copies per milliliter. We also need a more adequate understanding of how STIs affect transmission rate, because I don't think you can make a statement saying that if the partner is STI-free, you won't have any transmission with undetectable viral load on heart, because we don't fully understand how frequently asymptomatic STIs, for instance, could happen, what the effect is on viral load, and how that could actually cause a transmission over a certain period of time, and not just at the point that the low viral load was measured.
Yeah, okay. I mean, so you're just saying, I mean, one transmission at less than 40 copies would be enough to say that the Swiss statement was wrong. Would that be enough?
From a logical point, that would be enough. From a statistical point, I don't think that's an accurate assessment.
Yeah. I mean, the point I'm getting to is we will probably never have data that would say that statement
is
wrong. We would probably never have data to say that statement is wrong, unfortunately.
Well, hopefully we should have a pretty accurate estimate of transmission risk in this group after the Myron-Cohen study, which is the one that's finishing in 2016, is done. So we should be able to get closer to defining actually how many transmissions would occur, what the risk is in that population. But please go ahead.
Hello. I'm Dr. Marshall Pisuza from Fort Myers, Florida, United States. Mine is rather a comment rather than a question. I follow a large number of patients, and I always tell them to practice safe sex. But in real life, what we preach and what goes on is quite different. Yeah. I have several discordant couples wherein the man is negative and the wife or the partner is positive, and the wife is doing fine on heart, CD4 count is high, viral load is low. In spite of telling them repeatedly to practice safe sex, several of them have told me they are not practicing safe sex, and the man is doing well. Some of them have come for testing, and they are negative, and some of them have not come for testing. So in real life, this thing goes on, what you just now discussed, in a big way. Thank you.
It's a very important point. Thank you very much.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you. Gracias.
Dr. Aisi.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I feel very much honored and privileged to stand before you and make a presentation on the work we have done in Kenya on integrating cancer and testing for HIV in family planning services. And I thank the scientific panel for this great honor and privilege. Background of my presentation, or outline the background, methodology that we used, what were the findings, lesson learned, conclusion, and way forward. Kenya is a a country in this region of Africa. Important demographic data is that it has a population of 34 million, conservative privilege rate of 39%, which has plateaued for last two DHSs, and total fertility rate of 4.9. Family planning and maintenance of 2.4, HIV prevalence of 7.4 as per CAIS 2007, and prevalence among the women in reproductive age is 9.2%. There is low VCT coverage and low condom rate. Low condom rate usage. 50% of the new infections are found within the youth 15 to 24 years of age. Integration of counseling for HIV in family planning services potentially increases the range of services available for family planning clients, many of whom are at risk of STDs, including HIV, in high prevalence setting. Systematic evidence of offering CT in family planning settings has remained extremely limited despite widespread interest in this model of family planning HIV integration. Why integrate HIV services? The government policies support integration of services within the National Health Strategic Plan 2. Clients seeking family planning and HIV AIDS share common needs. Most clients are sexually active and fall within the reproductive age bracket of 15 to 49 years. They are at risk of HIV infection or may be infected, and they need access to contraceptives. Need to know how HIV affects contraceptive options like interaction between hormonal contraceptive and HIV regimens. Prevention of unwanted pregnancies is a key PMTCT strategy that has received very little attention, which can be addressed through integration of services. Our study objectives was to develop and implement two models of integration. One was for testing model and referral and evaluate the models in terms of feasibility of implementation, acceptability to both client and providers, effect on the quality of family planning services, effectiveness in increasing uptake, incremental cost that is required on this addition of services, and to disseminate and utilize research to create conditions for scale-up of integrated services provision nationally. Our methodology. We used pre- and post-intervention design to obtain information. Thus, measurements were conducted at both baseline and endline. Our participants were family planning clients and their providers. The sites used were two in Central Province, Nyeri, which had 9 facilities that where piloting was done and had low counseling and testing services. And Thika had 14 facilities. The peculiar thing is that it had high family planning, high counseling and testing availability. A health facility assessment of the readiness for a facility to offer counseling and testing for HIV within family planning was conducted. Data were collected through provider client observations and exit interviews for the clients. A pre- and post-intervention focus group discussion with health providers and the clients were conducted to collect the relevant information. Two models of integration were piloted. The referral model, where clients were educated on family planning, about counseling and testing and referred for testing and post-test counseling to other sites within the facility or elsewhere, even to a standalone VCT site. And the testing model involved educating family planning clients about counseling and testing and offering them counseling and testing for HIV within the routine visit by family planning providers as well as post-test counseling. This means that HIV and family planning services were given by one provider in the same clinic at the same time. The interventions we put in place was sensitization of provincial and district teams about integration process, developing or training material and reviewing the existing one to encompass integration of services, adaptation of balanced counseling strategy from the South African generic to be used, the logarithm to be used for counseling clients on family planning and STDs. We modified the family planning registers to allow routine collection of information of counseling and testing services. In this way, we added one column to collect counseling and testing information. MOH supplied basic commodities, including test kits and family planning methods. The health workers were trained on provision of family planning, balanced counseling strategy, and counseling and testing. Results. Most facilities were ready to offer family planning, HIV family planning integrated services. At least 70% of them had basic supplies, equipment, and appropriate infrastructure in place. Integrated approach was acceptable to providers and clients. In some focus group discussion, this is some of the answers we got. We encourage our clients to use dual protection and know their HIV status. This is information we got from a service provider. And it is better for my family planning provider to test me and know my status. Information from a focus group discussion by a client. Overall quality of family planning services improved. The quality of family planning counseling improved where providers discussed at least two or more family planning methods in 73% of the consultation at end time compared to the baseline. And quality of counseling for STI HIV issues improved where providers discussed in 80% of the consultation at end line compared to 37% at baseline. Providers explained that condom protects against STI and HIV as well as pregnancy, emphasizing the dual function of the condom in 48% of the consultation at end line compared to 16% at the baseline. The information just shows you that at the baseline, the services were low compared to the end line in both testing and referral, showing that integration of services is very important and improves the service provision. This shows the effectiveness of uptake of services in comparing the baseline and the end line. Integration works in both, but is better in the testing where services were offered in the same clinic by the same provider at the same time. We looked at the cost analysis of the testing model, and we found that incremental services, incremental average cost per family planning client tested for HIV is about $2.5, and this includes labor, test kits, gloves, and supervision. This compares well with the work that was done earlier in the year 2000, where estimated cost of offering one client services at a standalone VCT site costed $27. What are the lessons learned from this? That supporting services delivery guideline and emoji leadership is very important if we have to achieve a lot with integration of services. Advocacy is key at all levels, including national level, the provincial level, and the district level. We have to build consensus amongst stakeholders for buy-in and ownership of the integration services. Ensuring commodity security is important for continuity of services and sustainability. After the information to the clients are now demanding testing services to the increased knowledge within the family planning clinics. There is reduction in stigma because of good rapport that has been established between clients and service providers. The enabling factors for this success was conducive policy environment that allowed integration to be incorporated within services, and existence of a technical committee on integration that advises the government on integration of at national level and at provincial levels. Availability of suitable training materials that were used to impart knowledge to the health workers. There were ready available trained service providers and ready infrastructure where family planning services were already being offered. the strong and willing partner support. Challenges, human resource shortage, weak logistic management system for commodities and supplies that led to occasional stockout, inadequate equipment in some facilities, lack of space in some facilities that compromise confidentiality in counseling and testing, and clients exerting pressure on need of service. In conclusion, integration is visible without compromising coverage or quality of existing family planning services. Provider initiated counseling and testing and HIV AP integration is acceptable to both client and providers, and access, quality, and uptake of HIV counseling and testing improved integration of services. Use of balanced counseling strategy tools facilitated integration. Way forward, we have to notice a national scale up for counseling, testing, integration, ensure counseling family planning services is captured in the national reporting tools, and ensure that this approach is factored in the pre-service training to produce workers that are able to offer these services. Supplies and commodities need to be sustained. I acknowledge all of my colleagues that we work together with on this work, and no missed opportunities. We have to integrate family planning with HIV services. Thank you.
Gracias, Dr. Isis. ¿Tienen alguna pregunta?
Hi, Tim Farley from WHO. Thank you very much for that. I think this is very useful to get information on the practicality of integrating services in this way. There's one whole aspect, which is a potential downside that you haven't looked at, and maybe you have some qualitative information on this, but maybe it needs to be collected as you go further on, which is, was there any adverse effect on the quality of the family planning service that was provided? You've only given us measures of the acceptability of the testing, and you've given us measures of the incremental cost of providing the testing. But you also want to make sure, as this program is rolled out, that you're not having an adverse effect on the quality of the family planning services, or maybe, in fact, driving people away from the family planning services. They choose not to come to the clinics where the HIV testing is being routinely offered.
Thank you. What I showed you that the integration of services actually improved the family planning services, and we did not note anybody running away from the clinic where counseling and testing was being offered. The referral clients were given a voucher to report with the next place where they are going to be tested, and we did not report many people who missed out to go and access the services.
Could I ask, Robert, can I ask specifically what reproductive health services were provided?
Pardon?
Specifically, what reproductive health services were provided? What do they entail?
In this study, we only gave, it was family planning service, and we were integrating counseling and testing for HIV. That's the only service as an entry point for integration of services.
Adelante.
Thanks. Kelly Carney from Chicago again. I applaud your efforts to integrate HIV and family planning services, and very much agree with you that family planning has been very much overlooked in the response. I'm curious, are there any efforts underway to integrate family planning into HIV clinical care? When I hear about FP-HIV integration, it seems that so often HIV is being integrated into family planning, but family planning is not being integrated into HIV. Thank you.
Think we have looked at the model where actually in our clinical setup we've already integrated family planning within counseling and testing in clinical care. It's already done as the second strategy. And we are into integrating other services with HIV AIDS, including TB in CCC or community cancer centers and STIs. In comprehensive care centers. So we are looking at integration of services to offer continuum of care for HIV AIDS clients.
Deborah Joseph from PSI. Thank you for your presentation. I think it's interesting to see how it's being operationalized in Kenya. My question is about HIV-positive women. I think another thing that you missed in your presentation is the reduction of vertical transmission. One of the key things we're trying to do is try to prevent unwanted pregnancies among HIV-positive women so that we can reduce mother-to-child transmission. I'm wondering what kind of prevalence you had in your site in terms of HIV-positive women and what kind of uptake was continued in terms of family planning methods and if there was a change in that method.
Yeah,
another thing we've seen is also among a change of provider behaviors of really encouraging condom use rather than family planning or contraceptive use once they find out that the woman is HIV-positive. And I'm wondering if you saw any of that either. Also, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for those concerns. I've said in the demographic data in Kenya that HIV prevalence was higher in women in reproductive age. And the much we have done on prevention of mother-to-child transmission, we have achieved quite a lot on prong 3 and prong 4, but very little has been done on prong 1 and 2, particularly prong 2, where we have to prevent unwanted pregnancies in HIV post women. So we think within the creation of services, we can be able to capture this and get a lot of results. In the CAIS report that we had just a few weeks ago, it's showing 50% unmet needs of family planning among HIV positive women.
That's
so we think integration is going to help us to achieve that.
La última pregunta, doctor Reisler.
Just a very short question. The women who tested HIV positive in your integration trial, how were they referred, and was there a possibility to continue treatment within the family planning clinics? Were you also starting to train providers to keep them in care in that trusted facility that they were accessing already?
The positive women in the city were...
They were sent to different facilities.
Every facility has a comprehensive care center. So they were able to be referred for care and treatment within the facilities.
Bueno, muchas gracias. Muchas gracias al Dr. Aisi. Y damos por terminada la sesión gracias a estas interesantes intervenciones y nuestra felicitación a todos los ponentes por sus excelentes trabajos que creemos que están en un reto interesante, temas muy importantes para nosotros también, obviamente en América Latina, la integración de servicios, la utilización de terapias en pasar de un sexo no seguro a un sexo seguro, y la famosa circuncisión que para los latinoamericanos es muy controvertido. Muchas gracias por todo.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much to all the presenters, really excellent presentations, and to the audience for staying throughout. Thanks. Have a good evening.
Okay. Thank you very much. That was great.
Thanks.